This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
And a very good afternoon to you. Today we're going to take a closer look at those conflicting reports that China has temporarily paused iron ore sales with BHP. We'll get to that shortly here on the Country Hour. And then a little later in the hour, one of Australia's largest wine producers is now using aluminium bottles. We'll find out why a little later this hour. And then it's off to Katanning for the results of the sheep market just before the news at 1 o'clock. 12:05 here on the Country Hour on the ABC, right across Western Australia. First today, a former Director of Grains and Innovation at the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development says it's great to finally have a location for a new primary industries research centre. But what's missing is a plan for agricultural R&D in this state and a vision for what the sector will look like in 2050. Dr. David Barron is a private consultant working for a range of clients, including DPIRD. He worked for the department for 30 years, retiring as Director of Grains and Innovation 10 years ago. He's been looking at this morning's announcement from the Cook government to invest $55.7 million in a new 2.75-hectare site at Jandakot to host WA Primary Industries R&D, as well as securing a new 5.5-hectare site at Wanneroo for grain, pastures and irrigated agricultural field research trials to commence in 2026. David, what do you make of the plan?
Well, it's good to see. First of all, we've got a location and we've got an investment strategy in the sense of having some dollars committed to a location where researchers can go. We've also got a plan in the sense of having some field plots, albeit a bit further away than what most researchers would ideally like in terms of doing their research that's involving, you know, pathology, etc., because that was the advantage of South Perth. Everything was on the same site. People could go out, look at their plots, and bang, they would be back and doing work straight away. It's perhaps not the best solution, but it is does mean that people are still able to engage in a close location. I suppose the thing is, when I looked at where they were talking about Jandakot, it does have some advantages. You know, the location in respect of Curtin, of Edith Cowan, perhaps UWA Murdoch, the advantage of having the freeway system means that you can get to those locations pretty quickly. Nothing was talked about with regard to public transport or anything like that, but Jandakot, you think there is the opportunity to use the rail network somewhere in that system. In terms of people coming in from country locations, then obviously rail highway and the freeway system allows some that relatively easily into Jandakot. So from those points of view, it's probably quite good. Is it going to be big enough? I don't know.
Yeah, what do you make of the spend? How adequate is that, considering originally, there was a $320 million proposal to have the head office, a building at Murdoch University, and now we've got a $55 million plan at Jandakot.
It does seem on the small side. You know, we all know that most construction projects tend to go over budget, so whether the question it will be in budget is going to be an issue. But the other thing I suppose that I looked at and would consider is, what's the room for expansion? You know, you've got 2.75 hectares. Does that facility have the capacity to expand in the future if the needs of the primary industry sector increase? Or is it going to be so constrained that it's just going to be stuck there? I mean, it's not explained clearly whether or not the government owns the land, whether it's leasing the land, and in the same respect of the Wanneroo site, is it owned or leased? Because obviously that has implications for what the future holds, maybe 10, 20, 30 years down the track. I think probably it's on the smaller side. I know that when we did, you know, some work at Northam, which was, you know, $15 million just to put in the improved glasshouse complex, the sheds and stuff, we didn't get a great deal for $15 million, and that was over 15 years ago. So it does seem a bit on the small side.
How logical is it, though, to have headquarters in Jandakot and the trial sites at Wanneroo? As you said, back in the old days at South Perth, you could just walk out of the office and the trial sites were just there with you on the same site. Very convenient. But couldn't they have made use of facilities, say at Murdoch, where DPIRT already has invested in glass houses, or at UWA, Shenton Park, where DPIRT leases land and has a research station? Why not take advantage of those sites that are already there established?
Well, I will assume that they're actually still going to use those and that they're not going to disappear. But when it comes to doing large-scale plots, which, you know, you probably do need the multiple hectare sites, you need to be able to run rotations on that stuff so that you don't get disease build-up. So you're probably going to have to go to an alternative site, perhaps like Wanneroo. You know, you are picking, I'm assuming that they're picking a site which has had horticulture in the past, so it's got access to water and all those things. And I'm assuming that they've done due diligence in terms of the quality of the soil and all other sorts of things in this process. If that's all occurred, then it might be a good site, but you are right in the sense that you know, researchers do like to have the best access they can for their facilities, which is why Northam was done with the Grange, is that, you know, people can walk out the door and they've got their plots over the road, or they've got their plots which are all protected from birds right next door. So you actually do enhance the researcher's ability to do it.
To what extent does this plan help future-proof WA's agriculture and food sector?
Well, I mean, first of all, in my opinion, it's not necessarily a plan. It's a location where you're going to put some people. How you then use those people, how you use the leadership team within DPIRT to facilitate the R&D direction and the growth and the innovation in the industries is actually probably the critical plan. This just gives you a facility where you're going to put some people. I can't necessarily see it as being the whole plan. I see it as being part of the jigsaw, which is the plan for Western Australia. And I think it does require a substantial amount more thinking about what do we want to look like by the year 2050, when potentially we are going to have a lot more consequences of some of the effects of climate change.
What are the risks of not taking the agricultural sector seriously, not formulating a plan to take us 10, 20, 30 beyond years into the future?
Well, if you listen to the global discussion that's being talked about at the moment with regard to food security, you would say that it's an absolute necessity, because you've not just got the problems of increasing heat affecting crops, increasing drought, flooding, fire. You've also got the issue of climate migration, i.e. people moving and where they're going to move to. You know, Western Australia's population is growing. It's continuing to grow. Eastern States is continuing to grow. Trying to work through a strategy which addresses those issues, making sure, you know, the fresh food supply is there, that the ingredients you need for value adding are there, making sure you understand how the export industry is going to continue to work. You know, there's a whole series of different issues there which need to be thought through. I think, you know, you've seen some really good moves within DPIRT. You know, they've appointed three new research directors, grains, horticulture and livestock. It's a great opportunity for DPIRT to use those people to actually think about how they develop a long-term strategy, which is not just about what the industry is going to look like. It's where the people are going to come from, how they're going to be trained, how they're going to continue to work in with the regional locations. That's the opportunity that's potentially being created by starting this process.
How confident are you that that's going to happen?
I think there are some moves that are actually going in the right direction. The fact that the people that they've appointed to some of those senior leadership positions are actually quite capable from what you read on paper. Hopefully that they're actually engaging with their staff.
But in the meantime, aren't there senior people leaving the department?
Look, it's always, every organisation has senior people leading on an ongoing basis. Unfortunately, DPIRT has lost a lot of the people who started doing research back in the 1980s, 1990s, and who built up a huge intellectual resource. Once they go, it's very difficult to retain that. The new younger generation coming through are not necessarily having access to those people and their thinking, and so you don't get that training process. But against that, you've got to totally different world with, you know, the use of artificial intelligence, etc. People have access to information we never had when I was doing a start out. I was reliant upon another person to give me and help me. Now you've actually got a different process. I think the universities, how they integrate into this is going to be really, really important, because we want to make sure that the training that they get at universities, that next generation of researchers and senior leaders, is actually right on the ball.
David, really good to get your thoughts this afternoon. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. David Barron, he's a private consultant. He works for a range of clients, including DPIRD. In fact, he worked at DPIRD for 30 years, retiring as Director of Grains and Innovation about 10 years ago. And his thoughts on the state government's announcement to invest $55.7 million in a site at Jandakot to host WA Primary Industries Research and Development, as well as securing a new 5.5-hectare site at Wanneroo for grain pastures and irrigated agriculture field research trials, which should start in 2026, so next year. What do you make of the plan? Those two different sites, headquarters at Jandakot, trial sites at Wanneroo, and is it enough money? $55.7 million spend. By the way, I did request an interview with the Agriculture Minister, Jackie Jarvis. She's not available today. Maybe tomorrow. We'll see. 16 past 12. Let me know on the text your thoughts. 0448 922 604. This just in from Dee, who says, going to be some good second-hand utes coming up for auction. It's a long way from Jandakot to Wanneroo, a very short-sighted and underfunded idea. Be part of the conversation on the text, 0448 922 604. Myling farmer and chair of Grain Producers Australia, Barry Large, says while any investment in agriculture is good news, he's concerned this spend falls well short, especially when you consider in 2023, the state government announced it would invest $320 million building a world-class biosecurity and research facility at Murdoch University, only to be scrapped a year later. Barry Large wants to know how a $320 million plan for agricultural research in this state became a $55.7 million plan.
I think that's please explain why we're only getting 1/6 now, or a fraction more, is the question. And with the grains industry being so invested in Western Australia, demise of the sheep industry, we're seeing more cropping go on. So more R&D needs to be done for growing varieties and things in higher rainfall areas. And so it is a bit disappointing, really, to think that we've only got $55 million spent into invested into this. But I will say it again, it is good that there is something coming, but you just wonder, is that all they value for the grains industry, considering how much money it brings to this state?
Well, the plan in 2023, the campus would house 350 staff and it would have facilities like state-of-the-art labs to replace some of the ones from the 1950s. This plan for Jandakot involves about 100 research and scientific staff. Does that staff number concern you as well when you think about the support that industry needs into the future?
Absolutely, it concerns me, because the amount of effort that needs to be put into keeping this industry as prosperous as it is, but we need to keep advancing ourselves. We need to be able to make sure we can take advantage of technological advances to keep us profitable as growers. So I say it again, we need good investment in the grains industry, and we need to, we talk about streamline and strengthening. I'm not sure where the streamline and strengthening is here.
Well, if we look 2024, the state government opened its new State Biosecurity Response Centre in Canning Vale, and that was to manage what it says is increasing pest and disease threats to agriculture and the environment. I know biosecurity is a hot topic at the moment, and particularly in your circles. Do you feel like that model and having research housed quite separately to biosecurity is best practice when we think about the efficiency that you've touched on?
No, there's too much disconnect. We need these places to be together to try and achieve some or flow through the business. And we're putting a little bit here and a little bit there and a little bit down there. I struggle to see how the dots can connect to return to the grains industry and be the most efficient. I really do.
Marling farmer and chair of Grain Producers Australia, Barry Large, speaking to Joe Prendergast about the state government's plans for agricultural research with a $55.7 million plan, headquarters at Jandakot and trial sites at Wanneroo. On the text, Ian says, move the lot to Northam. Do you agree, disagree? Let me know. 0448 922 604. 21 past 12.
The Country Hour.
I found it pretty good, actually.
Yeah, that's a great question.
You never knock back rain.
The Country Hour.
You know, you should get around it.
Part of your community and your life for 80 years on ABC Radio.
We'll check in with the news headlines very shortly for you. And there is some breaking news this afternoon. The US government has shut down for the first time in nearly 7 years after a vote to extend funding past a midnight deadline failed in the US Senate. I'm sure there'll be an update on that in the headlines and in the news bulletins to come. 21 past 12. And one other issue in the news this afternoon is that iron ore analysts are saying that China still needs Australia's iron ore, but Beijing's interference in the market could affect future supply. And this comes amid conflicting reports that China has temporarily paused iron ore sales with BHP. Bloomberg is reporting the ban was enforced after contract renewal talks between the mining company and China Mineral Resources Group hit a snag. Iron ore researcher Philip Kirklechner is the former chair of the Australia-China Business Council. He describes the China Mineral Resources Group as a cartel organisation that was set up 3 years ago with the aim of gaining more control over prices, but says, make no mistake, China still needs our iron ore.
This is clearly shows how different China's system is, where political and national security are overriding everything else, might even override economic interests. And so this is a sign of an organization was founded a few years ago in order to help China to control the price of iron ore. And at the beginning, when the organization was set up, I didn't have a lot of confidence that they would be able to enforce discipline amongst the many steelmills in China to actually follow central directives. But I think in recent months, the government has made it clear that they want to enforce more power over the way iron ore is managed.
And it we've seen already in the past 20 minutes, BHP share drop almost 2%. How fragile are these systems then, if this is just based on reports and things like that?
Well, people need to realize that China is a very different system from our system. If you go to China today, it looks very welcoming and free and well managed. But at times when interests clash, sort of the true colors of the system emerge, and the system has very hard edges. And clearly, since Xi Jinping came to power, he would like to increase the power the central government has over the economy, and in particular, its industries. And whether these industries are private or not, he likes to exert control. And in spite of the fact that Australia has done a hugely successful job in helping China to keep the iron ore price low by increasing production significantly over the last 20 years, in spite of that, whenever the iron ore price goes up quickly, the government quickly sees the fault on the supplier side. And that's why it set up this cartel organization in 2022 to control, get more control over pricing and the way iron ore is imported. And this is obviously a problem. If you have governments trying to exert influence over markets, and it's a dangerous game to play, because if government is doing these kind of things and tries to interfere in the markets, it could affect future supply. You know, why should mining companies explore and maintain production if they're faced with threats such as these? But I think BHP is not the only one who is really affected by this. In the future, anyone could be affected who is not doing everything that is possible to please the buyer. So I think it's clear that tensions have risen. But in the end, China needs the iron ore. So,
and what's the other options if people don't want to keep going to China? Is there the opportunity to diversify, look to other buyers, other countries?
No other country is even near China in the size of its steel industry and its requirement for iron ore. India is a rising number two, but it will take many years for India to increase steel production anywhere near what China has today.
Director of Iron Ore Research, Philip Kirk-Lechner, speaking to Mieta Adams. And Philip has worked for FMG and Rio Tinto and has also been based in China. 26 past 12, National Party leader David Littleproud is in WA today and hopes this is not a case of China trying to flex its muscles.
Well, let's hope not. In fact, yesterday I was in Newman. I was actually in Jimblebar mine with BHP, looking at their operations there and seeing the thousands of people that they employ here in Western Australia. So we hope that that this isn't China doing anything untoward. That in fact, this is a dispute that can be sorted out with dialogue, and dialogue is the best way to resolve any dispute you may have. So hopefully that we get some clarity on this. There's a lot of questions being asked at the moment. I don't think we should panic. I think we should understand that there is still a global demand for iron ore, and that obviously if they don't purchase from BHP, they'll take it from other suppliers and the market will recalibrate, supply will recalibrate amongst those suppliers. But what we'd prefer to see is that BHP and their Chinese buyers can come to some arrangement.
So alert but not alarmed is what you're saying. I mean, we have, as you said, we've been reliant on this iron ore sale to China for such a long time. I mean, how do we get ourselves ready for a future where that may not be the case?
Yeah, and that's a great question. I mean, it's worth about $138 billion iron ore exports to Western Australia and our great country. So it's important that we try to diversify, but the sheer appetite for iron ore has been through China and the expansion of the Chinese economy. Obviously, that's not going to be forever. So it is important that we look for alternative markets, but that is challenging, and you've got to understand there's competing forces. That's why here domestically it's important that governments create an environment for not just BHP but for all mining companies, particularly here in iron ore, that we create an environment where the regulatory burden isn't expensive but it's one that protects our environment and protects our workers, but ensures that we make ourselves competitive internationally, because things will tighten. You're seeing that there's a housing issue now hitting the Chinese economy as well, and so you should see construction probably reduced, and that's going to put downward pressure on the demand. And so it's important that we get this right and we make sure that we're not just looking at iron ores but other minerals that in our rich country of resources that we tap into to look at a changing economy and changing global demand for resources, whether it be iron ore or other rare earths.
Nationals leader David Littleproud speaking to Geraldine Mallett earlier today on the ABC Morning Show. 29 past 12, Jonathan Beale in the studio with the news headlines.
Thanks, Belinda. A US federal government shutdown has officially begun after Republicans and Democrats failed to strike a deal in time. Under the shutdown arrangement, federal employees considered non-essential are put on leave without pay, and non-essential government services come to a halt. It's the country's first shutdown since 2018. The President, Donald Trump, had threatened irreversible cuts if the shutdown occurred. A man who raped a 16-year-old girl in a public toilet in a beachside Perth suburb has been sentenced to more than 6 years in prison. Fernando Salas Collard raped the girl at the Coogee Beach public toilets in January last year. He was on trial last week and a jury found him guilty on Friday. The 34-year-old had claimed in court that the sex was consensual. Salas Collard was made eligible for parole. And a man who threatened a senior police officer over his involvement in changes to WA's firearms laws has avoided a prison sentence. Mitchell John Hogan used a work phone to call the acting inspector's mobile in September last year and said, "We're coming for you," three times. She imposed a 12-month intensive supervision order, which requires him to undergo counselling. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Jonathan. 12:30.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Well, so far today we've had a look at those conflicting reports that China has temporarily paused iron ore sales with BHP. Sebastian on the text says, it's about time Australia wakes up that we can't rely on mining forever. We can't dig it out forever. And also taking a look at the state government's plans for agricultural research and development here in this state, unveiling a $55.7 million buy, we think it's a buy, of a site at Jandakot to host WA Primary Industries Research and Development, as well as securing a new 5.5-hectare site at Wanneroo, and that's for grain pastures and irrigated agricultural field research. So headquarters at Jandakot, the trial sites at Wanneroo. On the text in response to that, Jack in Jero says, just some rough maths here, but if we have the original 2023 proposal of $320 million and take away this new proposal for ag R&D of $57 million, approximately equals the cost of a racetrack. Labor robbing the regions once more for vanity projects, according to Jack. And this too, why do all the facilities have to be located in Perth? Why not use the existing buildings in Northam, Meriden or Geraldton? And this text, agree with the suggestion to move the lot to Northam. And when will the multi-million dollar deep-herd wasteland at Bentley be sold off, asks Wes. Be part of the conversation on the text 0448 922 604. Between now and the news at 1, we'll look at the use of aluminium bottles in the wine industry, and then heading off to Katanning for the results of the sheep market. Our first stop, though, is the Bureau of Meteorology, and Joey Rawson is with you today. How are conditions across the Southwest Land Division, Joey?
Not a lot going on around the Southwest Land Division for the next couple of days, Belle. We've had like a weak front that moved through last night that dropped a little bit of rain, but not much in that. But that has now contracted out to the east, and things are starting to warm up. We have a west coast trough, so temperatures are warming up ahead of a cold front and cloud band that's approaching. So we'll start feeling that on later on Friday through the lower west and southwest. But once we get to Saturday and Sunday, it's quite an interesting setup. We have this cloud band that basically stretches from the Gascoyne coast through Meekatharra to Kalgoorlie on Saturday, and we have a front that's going to be crossing the southwest. So on Saturday, we're going to have potentially 20 to 50 millimetres, maybe southwest of a line from Perth to maybe Esperance, and then we may have another band that's going to produce around potentially 20 to 50 millimetres as well, you know, through that Coral Bay coast, stretching through to Meekatharra and nearly getting to the goldfields on Saturday. And then once we get to Sunday, we're going to have some sort of shower activity southwest of probably Exmouth to Eucla, with that rain band stretching, you know, through the Gascoyne and goldfields and maybe through the central west. And again, We'll get about 10 to 20 millimetres through a fair area of that southwest parts of the state, but the most heaviest falls are probably going to be around the goldfields and southern parts of the Gascoyne and central west. And again, we could be getting around sort of 20 to 40 millimetres out of that on Sunday. And it just slowly moves to the eastern districts on Monday and Tuesday. So it's not a bad weather event if you want rain through the southwestern half of the state on the weekend. Well, Belle.
And then taking a look across the northern and eastern parts of the state, how's that looking?
Yeah, so we've got a bit of wind through the southern parts of the Kimberley and northern interior tomorrow morning, but we are starting to see those showers and thunderstorms just creep into the northern and eastern parts of the Kimberley. So for today, we may just get something through the far northern parts of the Kimberley, and then on Thursday and Friday, it just encroaches more from the east, so places like Cunnamulla and Argyle, and potentially even Halls Creek may get some storms on Friday, and then things start to retreat back to the northern parts of the Kimberley, and then we start seeing that feature that's going to produce the rain from the southwest through the western parts of the Pilbara and also squeaking into the interior as we get to the latter part of the weekend. So, things are changing a little bit in the north as well.
Thank you so much, Joey. 24 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Let's take a look at the rainfall figures with Richard Hudson.
Yeah, hardly any at all in the state. In the southwest, a few places had between 1 and 3 mils, but above that was just Walpole Forestry with 4, and then in the southern coastal region, Dalyup Park had 4, Esperance 3, Munglin Up 4, and Tallina Downs and the Duke had 3. Nowhere else had more than a mil.
And you're off to the show, the Perth Royal Show this afternoon.
Yeah, I am. I love getting along to the show, but partly for the wood chopping, partly for some of the rides, hoping to meet some of my girls there later on this evening. But I'm also there to just check out some of the competitions at the Perth Royal Show. But I can tell you there is only one competition that David Devenish is interested in, and that's the carrot cake baking comp. And his preparation started at the fruit and veg markets a few weeks ago.
A lot of people, September is a very exciting month. It's spring. It's grand final month, of course, footy finals month. But for me, it's Royal Show month. Lots of good produce around here.
It is.
Truly organic.
Yeah, if you go on the, if you scan the QR code,
yes,
you can give you all the information.
You know what? Yeah. I trust you.
Yeah.
I reckon this should do for this week's experiment. Maybe one more. Oh, yeah. I know a good carrot when I see one.
So based on last year's feedback, what have you been focusing on this time?
Okay, well, I've just been focusing on getting better, right? Because last year I just wasn't good enough. As happens every year, you get feedback after you bake. So the pink slip arrived in the mail a couple of weeks after the show, after I'd sort of picked myself up off the floor and sort of got up, started to sleep again and get back on with my life. And that slip had some constructive criticism. And so beefing up the spice was the main thing. But there's a few other things that I've thrown in there as well. I've focused on consistency of colour. The visibility of carrot in the cake has been a big one, so I've actually really brought that out in the cake. So all round, personally, I think it is miles better than it was last year.
And how many cakes have you baked this year to actually perfect this year's entry?
22. Yeah, 22.
22 in less than 12 months.
Well, you know, I think one has to refine their craft, right? And so it's been a journey this year, and not sure that there's really much more I could be doing at my 22nd cake.
So, David, you know, before we go in there and face the music.
Yes.
This is the best cake you think you've ever cooked?
Yeah.
Right. So if for some unknown reason, an unfair judging, that you miss out this year, is that the end of the carrot cake saga?
Well, you know, I'm not a quitter, right? And I know there are people in my family who would probably pay me money to move to something else, but I'll listen to the feedback. Hello.
How are you?
Here for the Carrot Cake Awards.
That's my favourite.
Hey, it's everyone's favourite.
It is. Just head down this way. There's a girl in high vis telling everyone where to go.
Okay, round to the right.
Yeah, round to the right.
Excellent.
Left, she's not there, but she should be there.
Okay, thank you.
Have a good night.
Well, see, there you go. There it is. Well, everyone loves carrot cake. And everyone is going to love my carrot cake. Everyone in a white shirt, white jacket in that judge. Hello. Any other questions?
Well, how have you dealt with peers being sort of jealous of this talent that you have?
Well, I mean, everyone's got to run their own race, right? It's not about me versus others. Frankly, it's about the carrot. Right? I reckon the carrot for centuries has been underrated. It's a staple, hasn't gone up in price. The other thing I'd like to point out is that who said the colour orange had to be named after oranges? So I'm pushing for carrot to be the new orange. Okay?
Now, I've seen your social media accounts and, you know, you've had your yard features, you've had...
hasn't that gone viral?
Your drone footage of holidays and so on.
Yeah.
So now that you've branched out with this carrot/orange cake, do you have more followers than you've previously had?
Well,
are you now an influencer?
Well, let's just say I haven't been approached for sponsorship, right? So, but I'm, you know, again, it's not about me. It's about the carrot. I mean, sure, you know, I mean, I've got a few extra followers, but... It's by no means about me.
And best of luck.
Thank you.
And let's hope we don't have a tantrum this year.
Well, I can't guarantee that. Class 39, exhibit number 227, we're looking for it. It's the moment of truth. Arts and crafts. Jams and preserves. All right, cookery. Gee, lots of people here. Going past the fruit cakes. Okay, I think we've got to go around the other side of the cabinet. 227. Highly commended. Look at that. Sure, I might not have picked up first prize, nor second. Highly commended. I'm happy. I'm a happy man. Wow! Oh, gee, thank you. You're the first person I was about to call. I've made you proud, Mum. No, yeah, I know. There were almost tears. Oh, it hasn't quite sunk in yet.
So close. Not quite the Carrot Cake King, but highly commended carrot cake baker David Devenish, still very happy with that, highly commended. And he was being interviewed by, believe it or not, his wife, Steph. And if you'd like to see some of David's videos, some of his work, just search Yard Features on Instagram. Quite entertaining. 17 to 1. This is the Country Hour on the ABC right across Western Australia. Heading to Katanning very soon, just before the news at 1, to go through the results of the sheep market. First, heading to Denmark, where winemakers Paul and Bianca Nelson have officially taken on the lease of Wignall's Winery in Albany. A few months ago on the Country Hour, you might remember hearing long-time owner Rob Wignall saying that he was stepping away from the industry after dealing with a tough blood cancer diagnosis. Since then, Rob faced another setback. A fire caused by a lithium battery explosion destroyed one of his sheds. But Paul and Bianca say they're keen to keep Albany's first cellar door winery operating for its wine and music.
A lot of people affectionately know the venue as a live music venue, and it's something that we've been asked repeatedly about if we will continue to do that, and we would like to. We're really happy to be kind of taking over such an iconic landmark and piece of history in Albany here.
So when you say you're taking over it, what do you mean? What's the new chapter you're entering?
It's a lot of growth. I mean, a lot of new exciting things. We obviously, from a sell it all perspective, you know, really wanted to grow our business to a point where we can operate daily rather than just, I guess, a few days at a time in Denmark. Albany is experiencing quite a big growth in population. We kind of feel it's the right time to make a move from a business perspective to an area that is going to give us a broader scope from our wines and exposure to that growing population, but also growing tourism. And Albany is kind of one of the biggest growth rural cities in Australia at the moment. So to be part of that is going to be amazing for us.
Can we just go back to how you got into this in the first place?
Used to get dragged kicking and screaming down on the weekends by mum and dad, who had a small vineyard in Denmark. So we'd drive down Friday from Perth, spend all day Saturday leaf plucking in the vineyard, and drive back Sunday and school on Monday. So yeah, exposure to vineyards at a relatively early age, and did my viticultural degree and kind of fell in love with the growing of the grape side of things. Did a study tour to France and realised there was a lot more romanticised kind of value attached to the winemaking, and really enjoyed that kind of history and obviously the tangibility of it all, and really capturing, I guess, the essence of every vintage in a bottle. The Great Southern really offered that kind of opportunity from almost like a frontier kind of winemaking approach. You know, really exciting things down here, and I still think that the best is yet to come in the Great Southern. We have so many great vineyards, such great soils and landscape and climate. And it's, I think, one of the regions in Australia that's producing some of the best wines now.
And we're also joined today by Bianca. Tell me a little bit about yourself.
I met Paul in Stellenbosch in South Africa, which is where I'm from. He was making wine at the time. We started a relationship, I guess, and fell in love. And then I moved to Australia and we got married. And then moved down to Denmark, started our business, had a few kids along the way. And now that was 16 years ago. So... involved in the wine business, but very much kind of back of house, keeping the cogs turning.
Can you describe to me a little bit about your business in Denmark and how that's different to Wignall's over here?
Sure, yes. So we've been running a cellar door and vineyard in Denmark since 2013. As Paul said, it's Karrieview Vineyard. So it was actually the first vineyard planted in the Denmark viticultural region, 1985, I believe. So beautiful Pinot and Chardonnay fruit. Like Paul said, just kind of looking to grow our cellar door. At the moment, Karrieview is open very seasonally, so we tend to only be sort of open holidays. Love meeting people that come down to the region and definitely want to be a part of growing the tourism and activating the whole Great Southern. So kind of put a bit of thought into making the move to Albany. Our kids are going to school here next year as well, so kind of moving the whole family over. We have known Rob for a few years, and he was kind of talking about wanting to take a step back, and we thought to ourselves, well, that's a good opportunity for us to kind of take off where he's kind of... yeah, handing us the baton, really.
What gives you confidence, Paul, to take on something like this, a project like this?
I guess we kind of like the risk. Given we've been operating for so long in Denmark, we see massive potential just from that consumer engagement, which is really important, especially from our, you know, sort of wine perspective. It really gives us an opportunity to engage more with people that come to the cellar door here. Huge demand for, yeah, things to do. There aren't a lot of winery operators in Albany either, or, you know, I guess event kind of venues as well. There's a few kind of cool breweries starting now, and I guess also it's that transition of that age. People are either retiring or handing over their business to a younger generation, and I think there's a bit of a gap in the market that we've seen, and Albany, yeah, is an amazing town, and people want to hear it from the horse's mouth as well. And I guess it kind of goes hand in hand at the moment with, yeah, people are drinking less as well. There's a big kind of movement towards, you know, towards health and environment, and yeah, we want to be part of that too. And it's not only just drinking less, it's about sustainable packaging, it's about kind of using lightweight products. All those kind of things have kind of played into that decision making for us. And yeah, we view the cellar door here as a big part of that direct-to-consumer approach.
New leaseholders of Wignall's Wine, Bianca and Paul Nelson, speaking to Kate Forrester. And they also own the oldest producing vineyard in Denmark. You can read more on the Wignall family stepping away from the winery on the ABC Great Southern website. Just search ABC Great Southern and you'll find the story by Amelia Searson and Kate Forrester.
11 minutes to 1 o'clock. One of Australia's largest wine producers is now using aluminium bottles. And as Annie Brown discovered, it's to reduce the weight and emissions associated with glass bottles.
In the cellar door at a winery in Victoria's King Valley, lots of time and money has been poured into a new kind of wine bottle.
In September this year, Brown Brothers launched the first commercially available aluminium 750ml bottle into the wine industry.
That's Emma Brown from Brown Brothers Winery in Milawa. They're using the bottle for their Prosecco. She says there's many benefits to using aluminium.
Being 40% lighter, that actually equates to being 400 kilos lighter when you put it on a pallet. And so you think about kind of through the route to market, it really allows us to save on transport emissions all the way into store. And then on the other hand, from a recycling point of view, it does allow consumers to actively recycle the package in a really simple way, or also participate in their local CDS program and gain 10 cents back.
In line with national targets, the Australian wine industry has the goal to be net zero by 2050. However, its use of heavy glass bottles is where the plan to lower emissions runs into a bottleneck. Wine Australia's ESG program manager Julian Marchant explains.
Packaging accounts for 44% of all wine supply chain emissions, and 29% is attributed to transport, and that includes transport within Australia and to overseas markets. The furnaces can run at about 1400 degrees Celsius to produce glass for wine bottles, and of course that requires a huge amount of energy. So that energy is normally sourced from fossil fuels, which means the production of glass is hugely emissions intensive as well. So there was a big focus when the emissions reduction roadmap was developed on looking at alternative packaging and also looking at lightweight glass.
Currently, the bottles are made in the USA, where more wineries are already using aluminium.
The aluminium bottle has been quite a labour of love. This has taken about 2 years for us to get into commercial production. We have partnered with CCL, one of our packaging partners, to produce this aluminium bottle in the US and then fill it here on our line in the Milawa Winery in the Hive. It's absolutely not cheaper to use aluminium. Unfortunately, given the scale and that it isn't available in Australia, it is a more expensive packaging format, and it is something that, rather than doing what's easy, we've chosen to do what's right. So paying the price for a more sustainable package to hopefully gain some economies of scale in the future, but unfortunately it is not cheaper to produce than glass.
Brown Brothers decided to produce the aluminium bottle as a limited edition over the summer to test if consumers will be receptive to the new look and feel.
The wine category is quite a traditional one, and there's inherently rules that we need to take into account when dealing with wine. We have had some pushback, particularly from traditional wine consumers who enjoy their wine out of a 750ml glass bottle. But as we see as a wine category, we're seeing less participation, so less people are actually consuming wine. So this is one opportunity for us to overcome some of the barriers for people to come into wine and broaden occasions for the wine category overall. It will allow us to ultimately do what we love to do in for the consumer in a 750ml glass bottle, but broadens the occasions for people to really love wine and come into the wine category.
Using glass to bottle wine goes as far back as the 17th century. And consumer attitudes towards change has historically been slow when it comes to wine. For example, the Stelvin screw cap, which was developed by a French company in the 1960s. It wasn't until the 2000s that it really took off in Australia. And now, the corkscrew is buried deep in the utensil drawer.
I think it's really interesting. The main question I get asked is, how do you balance innovation with history and really challenge the status quo with a company that has so much legacy and history? And I think what's really exciting is that we're always willing to push the status quo. We were one of the first companies to actually try Stelvin cap, and we didn't get the consumer adoption that we were looking for then. We actually ceased production of Stelvin cap back then, waited for the market to catch up, and then come back. And I think that there's an element of patience you can have in a family business, a multi-generational family business, and you can really do what's right for the future. The consumer doesn't always jump on day one, but if you know that it's the right thing to do, I'm really proud that we're able to do it within this business.
Emma Brown from Brown Brothers Winery, based at Millawarr, Victoria, speaking to Annie Brown. And if you'd like to see these aluminium bottle-shaped cans, you can just search ABC Rural and Wine, and that's where you'll find Annie's story on the ABC Rural website. 6 minutes to one.
Hello, I'm Stephanie Smale. Join me for The World Today. House prices continue to climb around the country as the new first home buyer scheme kicks in. The United States on the brink of a government shutdown as politicians duel over federal funding. And long jump gold for Australia at the World Para Athletics Championships with Vanessa Lowe leaping to victory. Those stories and more coming up on The World Today.
5 minutes to one to the markets now, and about 11,600 sheep sold at the Katanning sale yards this morning. Tracy Kilner's been at the sale today. Hello, Tracy. That total is down about 1,000 on last week. Can you run us through the prices?
A larger yarding of new season lambs were presented, with weights and prices easing, while the old season lambs were mainly presented in store condition. Mutton eased slightly, while a good number of mature wethers yarded sold to a top of $229 a head off shears. The new season lightweight lambs made $80 to $210. Trade and heavyweight sold from $200 to $275 a head. Old season lambs weighing under 16 kilos carcass weight made from 90 to 151. Heavier lambs sold from 134 to 190. And trade weight lambs made from 160 to $252 a head. The crossbred hoggets sold from 140 to 220. Merino store weather hoggets ranged from 148 to 152. While the medium and heavyweight sold $210 a head. Merino ewe hoggets returned from 80 to 145. For lightweights, medium and heavyweights made from $172 to $180 a head. The store mutton eased on quality, making from $50 up to $173 with a full fleece. Prime medium weight ewes returned from $167 to $205. And the heavyweight ewes over 30 kilos carcass weight sold from $190 to $222 a head. Mature store wethers sold from $166 to $168. Medium and heavyweights returned $156 to $229 a head. Mature rams sold from $50 up to $180. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Tracy, thank you for that. The total yarding today, 11,591 sheep. That is down 1,045 on last week's numbers. 3 minutes to one. Earlier in the hour, we were talking about the Cook government's announcement today to invest $55.7 million in a new site at Jandakot to host WA Primary Industries Research and Development. And on top of that, securing a new 5.5-hectare site at Wanneroo to do trial site work linked to grain pastures and irrigated agriculture, that all to start in 2026. In response to that, Saxon, a farmer at Katanning, has just called through. Saxon, what do you make of the plan and the investment?
I find it to be maybe a little bit of waste of money, just to where the money is going. To be buying land in Perth and putting trials into Perth, it's the wrong climate to start with. It's maybe missing the point just a little bit on creating another government department that's just going to be leeching off the taxpayer.
Because the original plan was $320 million to be invested at Murdoch University as the Deep Herd's headquarters, but you think even the $55.7 million is too much to spend?
Yeah, look, I think it would be, to be able to put it into a government department. There are private ones that are already being funded by farmers that are existing already. I think maybe if you made the grant into the private ones that exist, I think the money would be way more beneficial and a bit more well spent that way.
And so what should be the future of Deep Herd then if it's not doing any R&D work?
Yeah, look, I'm not sure there's much of a need for it. I drove past the Katanning Agriculture Department this morning and they've sown canola in June and it should be planted end of March, beginning of April. So I don't think government departments are the way to be progressive. in farming. I think maybe the private entities of what farming practices are reflect a little bit more in the private trials that are being done.
Saxon, good to get your thoughts. Thank you so much for that, for calling through. Appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks for having me on.
That's Saxon, the farmer from Katanning, with his thoughts on the government's plan that was announced today, $55.7 million, an investment, and that split between the headquarters at Jandakot, that's the plan. They've got some land there and also some land in Wanneroo for those trial sites. Hopefully we can have a talk to the Agriculture Minister, Jackie Jarvis, about the plans in some more detail and just see what her vision is for agriculture. We heard earlier in the show that that's what's missing here. We might have a location to put the staff now, but what is the plan? What is agriculture going to look like in this state, say, by 2050? Hopefully we'll talk to her tomorrow. News time now, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.